Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 90, recorded Sunday, May 22nd, 2011. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: more comfortable in India, and travel tech, tipping towards Android. This week, or actually should I say this month, it's been another full contact month of travel. I was out for a 2-week stint through the UK, India, and Germany, then a quick jog out to Phoenix, a week to San Francisco for the big Google I.O. conference, and now just returned from a 3-day trip to Madrid. You know, I got a lot of comments about the Madrid trip. Ooh, you're so lucky. Oh, I'd love to go to Spain. Most of these coming from my wife. Unfortunately, my Spain trip was just another business trip sandwiched between 2 8-hour plane flights. I left at 4:30 p.m. Tuesday, arrived 6:30 a.m. Wednesday, cabbed to the hotel, showered, changed, caught up on email, met the rest of the team in the lobby, spent the afternoon in a customer conference room, went back to the hotel room to catch up on email and conference calls, went out to dinner with the customer, back to the hotel room for more email and calls, sleep 5 hours, back in the conference room for a full day of meetings, dinner, email, conference calls, 4 hours of sleep, cab back to the airport Friday morning to catch a 9:30 a.m. flight home. So most of the time in Madrid was spent in a conference room without windows. So it could have been really anywhere. The one bit of Madrid that I had was on our last night, where instead of going out to a restaurant for dinner, we did a bit of a bar crawl on the street behind our hotel. A glass of Rioja, some tapas, then on to the next bar. It was good fun. I really enjoyed that. But I'll tell you, I was out and about more in San Francisco the week before. Now, I kind of had the opposite thing in Mumbai, where I had experienced perhaps more of the local culture than I wanted. My last day there in India was in Pune. Then I was to be driven to the Mumbai airport, about a 3 to 4 hour drive depending upon Pune and Mumbai traffic. No one told me the length of the drive until after I was in India and couldn't change my flight. My colleague's flight left at 10 p.m. Mine left at 2:45 a.m. I figured I'd hop the same car and just sort of hang out and nap at the airport. I mean, the drive between Pune and Mumbai was great. It cruised down a 6-lane divided toll road across some mountain range. Walking into the terminal, the security guard stopped me, said that I couldn't get in until 4 hours before departure time. So, what am I supposed to do? The cab driver had already gone, and I'd purposely left myself with only a handful of rupees. So, wandering around in front of the terminal, watching travelers pay their taxis, say goodbye, and I'm back to their families. Played a bit of coliform roulette, grabbing a bite to eat from a food stall. And then in my wanderings, I found the waiting area. So for 60 rupees, about a buck and a half, I could sit in air conditioning, important in Mumbai, ride the airport's free Wi-Fi, important for killing time, and use the men's room, just important in general. I'll tell you, it was a bargain at twice the price. So following up, Tony White dropped me a very germane question while I was in India. Tony writes, "I enjoy listening to your show every month and put the knowledge to good use. I have a question regarding jet lag and long flights to Asia and or Australia from the U.S. I am traveling on my first business trip to Asia and Australia in July. I've never traveled to Asia for business, only for pleasure. How do I prepare for traveling to Asia regarding jet lag and the time change? My first meeting will be less than 24 hours of arriving to Asia. Do you have a routine to prepare for those long trips? Do you sleep on the flight or do you stay awake to try and adjust to the time change? Thank you for the podcast and taking the time to answer these questions. Well, hey, Tony, not a problem. I'm glad I can answer these. I'll tell you, I've always approached time zone adjustments to Europe and Asia differently. I mean, going to Europe, just this past week when I was in Madrid, I set my watch on European time the minute I sit down on the plane and then force myself onto that schedule, eating quickly and then putting on the eye shades and the Bose headphones for sleep. Asia, though, it's an entirely different matter. I mean, you know, you got long flight times. I mean, it's 14 to 15 hours between O'Hare and India or China, and I don't know, 10 to 12 hour time differences. I honestly don't even try to figure out what the destination time. I just sort of go with the flow, eat, sleep, read, repeat until landing. I find that the flights are long enough to get enough sleep that I'm rested enough when I hit the ground to work right away. I mean, on this last trip to India, I hit Bangalore at midnight, and I was fine for an 8 a.m. breakfast meeting the next morning. Now, everybody reacts differently, but for me, I find it's easy to push through, you know, perhaps taking a one-hour nap before I go out to dinner the first day. I mean, I do usually sleep fairly poorly for the first three nights, but then I'm fine afterwards. I mean, everybody's body clock is different, though. If there's one thing I have learned, though, over the years, I think I'm getting on to decades of travel, you can only push your body just so far. Sleep is probably the most underrated and willingly ignored health tonic in existence. And I'll tell you, speaking of sleeping and flight, my recent travels have given me some experiences across a number of business class seats. Now, I haven't done any of the top carriers like Singapore Air, so, I mean, it hasn't been a life-changing experience for me. I mean, it's been more of a search for 5 hours of sleep before the next meeting. The difference, though, has been surprising. I mean, you think of an airline seat as a commodity, but I'll tell you, this has not been a commodity. I mean, the best seat, surprisingly, was on a United flight to London. 22-inch flat screen, complete lay-down seat, little pod. But then the United flight to Frankfurt was a huge step down. Little 5-inch screen, a almost lie flat seat, no separation between me and the guy next to me. You know, though it may not seem much, there's a big difference between a 170-degree and 180-degree seat recline. Difference between that 10% incline and lying flat is huge. Let's face it, your bed is 180 degrees, right? At 170, you end up having your knees locked, so you're trying not to slip down in the seat. It's not the ideal sleeping position. Now, the U.S. Air seat from Charlotte to Madrid was probably sort of at the rankings between sort of United, Lufthansa, probably at the bottom. I mean, it was a narrow seat. They had no screen. Instead, they had some metal prongs that held a 7-inch Arcos tablet that the flight attendant said was always a bit wonky. You know, sort of volume magically went up and down. Music would play while you're watching a movie. There was no real-time flight map to show your position or your ETA. And I'll tell you, and the food and wine was marginal at best. Yes, it was better than coach, but I'll tell you, that comparison isn't going to get me on another U.S. Air overseas flight. Now, while I was in the U.K. A few weeks back, I was amazed at the amount of cellular data my iPhone consumed. I mean, I had remembered to add the 100 megabit international data option to my AT&T plan before I left, and then I hit the usage counters. I hit the reset button on those before I hit Birmingham so I wouldn't overshoot. I was okay in Birmingham, but in London, I was consuming like 20 megabytes a day. And it was funny because, I mean, it's not like I was downloading anything. It's not like I was, you know, pulling music or podcasts over 3G. I mean, I saved that for the hotel Wi-Fi. So I started paying a bit more attention to my usage. Now, the difference between Birmingham and London was that I was walking to all my London appointments and was using Google Maps to find my way around town. I mean, resetting the usage counters again and again, I'd see that, you know, I was picking up 5 megabytes every time I started up maps. I mean, geez, I mean, I needed to find some paper maps or figure out another way to work this. So I ended up, I tuned my usage a bit. So I'd open up Google Maps in the morning while I was on the hotel Wi-Fi, and then I'd be scrolling around all the places that I'd visit that day, you know, quite honestly, just trying to load up, cache up as much of the map data as I could in memory. I mean, it worked pretty well, and it kept me from blowing past the 100 megabyte line. But at $200 for 100 megabytes of international data, I think before my summer vacation, where we're going to be driving through the Lake District in Scotland, I'll blow $50 on one of the GPS apps that comes complete with its own maps, downloaded. I do like the way, though, that all my electronics charge up at like seemingly warp speed when I'm overseas. I mean, most electronic chargers will handle 110 and 220 volts. I mean, the only exception I've found is my kid's Nintendo DS charger. So I don't bring a voltage converter when I travel, just a plug adapter. And I carry a small power strip, use the plug adapter to plug in the power strip, and then I plug my ever-growing array of charging devices into the strip. And like I said, plugged into a 220-volt socket, it's a quick charge. In episode 88, I interviewed Chris Truelove at the 2011 Travel Goods Show about his company BackToYou.com, which helps travelers retrieve lost items. So hopping in a taxi on the way to London Docklands Airport when I was flying out of London over to Germany, the driver gave me an AT&T phone that an earlier fare had left behind. He was trying to figure out how to find the owner's information so he could return it. I wasn't familiar with the model, but it wasn't locked, so I started poking around. I mean, calling the phone wouldn't help. It would just sort of only ring in my hand, so I flipped through the contact list. There was no ICE entry, that whole thing about in case of emergency. But I did find mom's cell and dad's cell, so I tried to call them, but international calls were blocked. Not too surprising. Then I tried to text them. Those bounced, too. So I played around for about 20 minutes, but no luck. Now, if it had had one of Chris's bag tags on it and they had been registered, I would have been able to send a quick text and his company would have sent a text to the owner. I'm glad I have one of his stickers on my iPhone and my two cameras. It was my first time flying out of London Docklands, which is just so much more convenient than Heathrow. I was staying near Tower Bridge, so I was already kind of on that east side of town, and was flying off to Frankfurt. It was a 20-minute cab ride, as opposed to at least double that to Heathrow, or taking a cab to Paddington Station to then catch the Heathrow Express. So I got there, no check-in line, short security line, free Wi-Fi, and generally just a more relaxed atmosphere than sort of the Heathrow insanity. I mean, it's a small airport, though, don't get me wrong. I was on a Lufthansa A319, an Airbus 319, I think, which looked like the biggest plane that they were flying out of there. I mean, it felt like the pilot had us backed up to the end of the runway, then he locked the brakes, revved the engine till the plane started to shake, popped the brake release, and then, whoom, off we roared like, sort of those Bonneville Salt Flats rocket cars. I mean, he rotated up right at the last moment, it seemed, going nose up just sort of before the Thames appeared beneath us. I mean, that definitely woke me up. It's a little bit of a rocket trip, but I recommend it over Heathrow if you're just hopping over to the continent. And finally, if you haven't seen it already, head over to the Travel Commons website or the Facebook page and look for video number 2, 5 hours, one city, Frankfurt. I had a 6-hour layover in Frankfurt on my way home from India, and rather than sit in a Lufthansa club all day, I ran through the 5-hour tourist sprint itinerary that was in United Airlines Hemispheres magazine. Now, the prior weekend, we had been in Kerala in India on the southwest coast. One of my hosts showed us how he was taking and editing videos all on his iPhone 4, which led me to videoing my Frankfurt spurt on my iPhone 4. Now, I cheated a little bit. I then pulled it over to the MacBook Air, but I edited it on the flight home, so by the time I landed in O'Hare, boom, I had it. Now, it's nowhere near as polished as the Vietnam video, but I don't know. I think it's a fun piece all the same. Check it out. I'd appreciate your comments. And always, if you have a question, a story, a comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address is, as always, comment, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. You can use the voice memo app on your iPhone or something like virtual recorder on your Android phone to record and send in an audio comment. Or you can edit something up in iMovie if you want to send me some video. As always, you can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock or post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page. Or you can always go old school and post them on the website at travelcommons.com. first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is more comfortable with India. At the end of April, I did my second annual trip to India. I changed some things up. Rather than doing the 15-hour nonstop from O'Hare to Delhi, I stopped off in Europe, did some meetings in the UK on the way over, and then I had that extended layover in Frankfurt that I videoed on the way back. This meant that I could skip Delhi, which I think it's a good thing, and stay in the southern part of India, Bangalore, Chennai, Kerala. That made things a bit more temperate. Temperature was in the 80s instead of the hundreds in Delhi that I got to experience on my trip last year. And I've also found myself a bit more comfortable with India. I mean, until my last day, when I was driving through Mumbai to the airport, I didn't see sort of the abject poverty that I saw last year in Delhi. I didn't feel the need to cling quite so tightly to my travel bubble as I did on my first visit, which we talked about in episode number 83. Now, it started with some of the planning. I mean, choosing and booking my own hotels in Bangalore, arranging most of my internal flights. I mean, that may seem petty, but on my first visit, my vendors organized everything. I just arrived and was sort of taken from place to place to place. Now, when I was doing the planning, doing some of the researching, and then making sure I had ways to get from point A to point B, it made me more of an active participant in this trip, just sort of not a passenger. I was also ready for some of the, call it uniquely Indian travel rituals, like the welcoming ceremony at each hotel, usually a combination of arati, I'll probably mispronounce all these, but arati, that kind of the oil candle or ghee candle circled in front of you, followed by a tilak, the red thumb mark applied between your eyebrows. And another very uniquely Indian travel ritual known as Indian airport security. At Cochin Airport in Kerala, we started counting the security checks. The first one was just to get into the airport. You either needed a printed itinerary or a printed boarding pass. I never saw anyone use the boarding pass on a smartphone. And, of course, your ID, passport, or whatever. Now, learning my lesson from last year, I printed out all of my itineraries before I left for India. Now, through the front door, we walked 200 feet and hit another security check, looking at the same papers, the same ID, before we could get to the check-in desk. So we get through that, then take an immediate left and put our bags on the x-ray machine. With them coming out the other end, the guy taped the suitcase zipper tabs together and sent us off another couple hundred feet to the check-in desk. Checked in, we then head over to the security line. Our boarding passes are checked going into the queue, and then we head to the men's security line. The ladies' line is off to the side with a curtain to pat down area. We put our carry-on bags through the x-ray machine, but we do get to keep our shoes on. We queue up in front of the metal detector. We walk through the metal detector and then onto a wooden stool or wooden step where a security guard wands and pats us down. Now, everybody gets wanded and patted down. I mean, it's the same whether you set off the metal detector or not. I'm not quite sure why they have the metal detector there other than, I don't know, maybe to help form the line. Well, anyhow, after the pat-down, which, by the way, is nowhere near as intrusive as the TSA pat-down, the guard stamps a boarding pass, proving that I've been patted down. Then I pick up my carry-on. It, too, has been stamped on a blank kind of luggage address tag to prove that it's been x-rayed. Now, at boarding, the gate agent scans our boarding pass while another security guard looks at the security stamps on the boarding passes and on the carry-on luggage bag tag. No stamps, and back you go. We get on a bus that travels all of about 500 feet and drops us at the plane. Another security guard checks our boarding pass, and then we're allowed to climb the steps and enter the plane. After 7 separate security checks. I had 5 flights in 7 days when I was in India. I tell you, I got pretty comfortable with the drill. But this trip, I just found myself a lot more comfortable just walking down the street. I mean, maybe because in Cochin and Kerala, there were enough European tourists that I wasn't the only white guy. But then walking through a huge crowd after an India Premier League and IPL cricket match on that Monday night in Chennai, I wasn't uncomfortable at all. And I was, we were the only white guys. I wasn't uncomfortable, or I wasn't any more uncomfortable than walking through the crowd after, say, a University of Michigan football game. I don't know, a little bit more familiar, a little less alien. Like I said, I just wasn't clinging to my travel bubble quite so hard. And so when I hit Mumbai airport and couldn't get inside for 4 hours, it didn't make me sort of worried or uncomfortable. Annoyed, yes, but not uncomfortable. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is travel tech. Tipping towards Android? So me and 5,000 other Google I.O. attendees walked out of Moscone West in San Francisco with some great swag. I mean, specifically a pre-release version of Samsung's 10.1-inch Galaxy Android tablet. I mean, it's a nice piece of work. It's sort of slightly longer, slightly narrower, and slightly lighter than the iPad 2. Now, there's no neat sort of smart cover that the iPad 2 has, but I'll tell you, it's a nice screen. I mean, and the setup was really easy. I just logged in with my Gmail ID, and the tablet just sort of automatically loaded all the apps that I have got installed on my Droid 2, on my Motorola Droid 2. I was carrying it around with me all conference, as was everybody else, and found that I really liked it. And now, there are definitely a few rough edges, and you'd kind of expect that with a pre-release model. Like, you know, when I plugged in the power cord, it acted like I was trying to sync it with my PC, and so it didn't let me use the tablet while I was charging it. Turns out I would just have to power it all the way down to get any sort of charge on it. But once charged up, I mean, the batteries were good. I mean, very, very solid battery life. But it's running the tablet version of Android, version 3.0 or Honeycomb, if you're into Google's dessert naming scheme. And actually, it's pretty stable. Now, the Android browser locked up and crashed a couple of times on me, but I don't know. Then again, so does my iPad Safari browser. And the Android browser runs Flash, so I can use it on sort of all those restaurant websites that won't display on my iPad. By the way, I agree that all those restaurant websites should swap out Flash for HTML5, but I will tell you, until then, I'd still like to be able to read their menus. I can't do it on the iPad. But obviously, it doesn't make sense carrying around two tablets. Indeed, people ask me why I carry a MacBook Air and an iPad. And even though I shouldn't have to take out either the iPad or the MacBook Air, because it's an 11-inch MacBook Air, I shouldn't have to take them out at the TSA screening station, because I've got the two of them in the backpack. They tend to lay one on top of the other. I'm always ended up pulling them out anyhow. So you add yet another tablet in the midst. It doesn't make any sense. So right now, I am still traveling with the iPad 2, probably more out of habit than anything else. But I find myself using the Samsung Android tablet around the house more and more. Now, actually, the bonus prize from the Google I.O. conference, I mean, I don't know, I'd call it a lanyap if Google I.O. was held in New Orleans, was the Samsung Verizon 4G hotspot that they sort of just sort of tossed into the mix because the Samsungs they gave us are only Wi-Fi tablets. I've been playing around with the hotspot in San Francisco, but I don't know, not so much because sort of the city is blanketed in Wi-Fi. However, sitting on the plane this week in Charlotte, waiting to head out to Madrid, long story about why I took this connection, or actually it's a rather short story, I ended up saving $3,000. But anyhow, sitting on that kind of beat-up US Air 767 with a lousy business class seat, I was trying to pull the last bit of email onto my iPad before takeoff, and I was getting nothing. There was no love from AT&T. In spite of seeing a full house of 3G bars. So on sort of a whim, I reached into my bag and pulled out the Samsung hotspot, fired it up, and it connected immediately. So I pull all my email and I'm jacking around. I download a couple of quick podcasts to keep myself occupied. And then, I don't know, I said, well, let's check this thing out. So I fired up the speedtest.net app on my iPad. I got 13 megabits per second download and 5 megabits per second upload. Phenomenal. And mind you, that's sitting on a bleeding plane, so in a metal tube, outside of Charlotte Airport. Trying it just now in the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, I got 7.4 down and 7 going up. Now that compares to 2.7 down and 0.9 up on AT&T 3G. I mean, not to pile on to AT&T, because that's kind of a bit of a fish in a barrel shooting exercise, but I'll tell you, if the next iPhone iteration doesn't have 4G, now that may be enough to push me to hug the little green guy. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 90. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. I'll tell you, I have no idea what bridge music I used for this podcast. I'm a little out of sequence for this podcast because I'm trying to get this assembled between travels. I'll figure out the music in post-production. Fancy words for when I assemble all the sound bits in Adobe Audition. Hey, but if you like one of the songs that I eventually end up choosing, you will, as always, be able to find the link in the show notes. Just sort of click through the read more at the bottom of the summary on the homepage. That'll get you to the detailed episode show notes. If you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com, or to mpcock on Twitter, or write them on the Travel Commons wall on Facebook, or post them on our website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken time to send in emails, tweet me, and post comments on the website. As always, safe travels, and until we talk again, thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons.
Life is hell, strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing needs my mind, the one woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling, crying into the phone,